Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Do you ever wish you were a lesbian? Don't you think it would be so much easier?
This is Tribeca Film Festival Live from WNYC. I'm James Ramsey.
And I'm Rachel Neal.
All festival long, WNYC has brought you exclusive coverage of the talks and panels with some of the biggest names in film today.
We've heard from Spike Lee, Amy Schumer, and Nate Silver about the projects getting the biggest buzz here at Tribeca.
And on this panel, director Brad Bird and the comedian we heard earlier, Reality Bites star Janine Garofalo, who worked with Brad Bird on Pixar's Ratatouille.
How many women do you see in this kitchen?
Well,
Only me. Why do you think that is?
Well,
Because haute cuisine is an antiquated hierarchy built upon rules written by stupid old men. Rules designed to make it impossible for women to enter this world. But still I'm here.
A cartoon with a message.
Yes, and a cartoon with a very smart comedian doing the voiceovers.
Brad Bird's one of the most prominent directors of animated films. He was 11 when he started making them, caught the attention of Disney at 14, and he went on to make The Incredibles, The Iron Giant, and he's even worked on The Simpsons as an animator.
Rachel?
What?
How could you forget Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol?
I don't know.
An hour ago, a bomb blew up the Kremlin. The president has initiated Ghost Protocol. The entire IMF has been disavowed.
So what happens now?
Cruise control. You know you're a fan. You know what I'm a fan of?
What?
Brad Bird's upcoming Disney movie Tomorrowland, the sci-fi epic featuring George Clooney and other live actors, which is inspired by Tomorrowland, the section of the Disney theme parks. Gotta be, by far, the best movie ever based off a section of a theme park.
I mean, that sounds cool, but I really want to see a movie based on that teacup ride.
Yeah, it's called Gosford Park.
Whatever. Here's Brad Bird and Janine Garofalo.
And welcome. I'd like to try and make this as exciting as an episode of Charlie Rose, if I can. A lot going on. Bradley.
Janine Lee.
May I, Brad Bird? Now, I was thinking, I was so honored when they asked me to do this, and I was thinking, what questions can one ask that he hasn't been asked a lot of times? But then at the same time, there are things you do want to ask. Now I'm wasting time doing this. I shouldn't deconstruct what I was thinking. Let's just get to it. For crying out loud. Okay, now, I did want to start with when you toured. I had read about that you had taken a tour as a child, as a young, maybe early teen. You were in Disneyland.
Yes. Well, actually, no, it was Disney Studios.
Disney Studios, right.
And I was 11, so I wasn't quite teen.
Oh, right. Well, they, you know, today an 11-year-old that is...
He's a tween.
Is a, approximately like a 27-year-old.
Yeah.
But back in your day, in my day, it was a young 11. But
yeah.
That's not important. What is that you were inspired by the animation that you saw at the time, and then you had sent some samples, which then got you a mentor.
Yeah, it happened a little differently. I had seen Jungle Book, and I was completely psyched by it, and it occurred to me that somebody actually made a living figuring out how a stuffy panther moved. And I thought, you know, I'd always thought as a kid that... adults were kind of, you know, you'd go to these parties and there would be the forest of legs and just very slow moving and lumbering people that kind of seemed boring. And I thought, oh my God, I'm going to grow up to be that. And then I realized that there were all these cool jobs and that one of them was that. One of them, you know, I remember my parents had a Jonathan Winters album. And here was this guy, you know, doing all these voices and sound effects, and he had a place in the world. You know, he could make a living. People were enjoying him. And I thought, it doesn't have to be boring. And then when I realized that somebody made these cartoons, that they didn't just happen, that somebody actually thought about this deeply, you know, it seemed like, wow, the adult world is very exciting. So I just tried to find anyone that I knew of that would be at Disney, and my parents' friends went to school with the composer for the Disney films. So I met him when he was up in Oregon, because he went to Oregon State University, and he said, next time you're in L.A., I'll take you through the studio. So that's what happened. He took me through at 11, and I met all the top people in the animation department. I actually knew who they were at that point because there was one book that I kind of read to death about the art of animation. And I remember meeting Frank and Ollie, who's two of Disney's nine old men, and they kind of gave me this look like, because George Brun said, who was the composer, said, Brad's interested in animation. They kind of gave me this look that was very nice, but it was this look of like, you're going to lose interest in 2 weeks, kid. Mm-hmm. And we'll never see you again. So they were kind of shocked 3 years later when I showed up with a 15-minute film. They responded to it, and that's when they kind of got me started mentoring.
So it's who you know, basically your parents, knowing the composer.
Huh?
This is the moral of that story. What one needs is parents that are well-connected, and then this happens. But... One of the things that I think everyone would find most interesting about your work is you have taken it to an extraordinary level. And it's almost as if you can see the difference between what is when you started and what can be. And within that construct, you've had to actually create ways to do it because there's limitations to the to the stories you want to tell. And to the way you want to tell it. Like with Ratatouille, there was software issues, as I recall.
There were less than on Incredibles, because we had done a lot of groundbreaking on Incredibles. So by the time Ratatouille came around, which is only one film later, the tools were way more advanced. So the animation of the humans was a lot easier. That the technology was more friendly to, and I think that you can see it in the quality. I love Incredibles and had a blast doing it, but we had to fight the machinery a lot on Incredibles.
Yeah.
And by Ratatouille, the machines were more friendly. So.
Well, there's, some people who don't, I think, appreciate that it is an art form. Sometimes when they think of what you're doing and what people like you are doing, I think they think it's a lot easier.
They think that there's a button that's like, make movie, right?
Yeah.
And it just gets done.
Right.
And they don't realize that the computers, they want to do everything exactly. They want to do things cleanly and evenly and hopefully geometrically, not organic. And if you want to do that, they can do it like no problem. They can spin a cube in space and da-da-da. But if you want them to present anything that approximates the natural world, they will fight you every step of the way. Mm-hmm. And they're less so now. They're getting better all the time. But all those flaws that you see, like in Ratatouille, on the kitchen floor, each one of those tiles, it is at a slightly different level. Well, somebody had to do that because the computer wants to do it exact, as if everything is perfectly placed. Mm-hmm. And if you want imperfections, you have to tell the computer, I don't want them to match. I want them to be asymmetrical. And that was done from research. When you have actual tiles that have been around for a while in a kitchen, they are not exact. Their levels are slightly different, so light hits them differently. And anyway...
No, that's what I remember. I remember that those conversations from when it was taking place, that the computer was just trying to clean everything up.
And you don't want it
all
clean.
The time.
Yeah.
And another thing, and then we'll throw to the clip, that I find fascinating, and I think everyone does, about what you've been able to do is within the genre that you're working in, you've actually...
It's not a genre, actually.
I'm sorry. What would it be called?
A medium. Animation is a medium.
I'm sorry.
No, it's okay.
And the medium is the message. Marshall McLuhan.
Yeah, there you
okay.
go. Okay, now you're centered again.
Back on track.
No, I just mean it can do any genre.
Mm-hmm.
It's that it doesn't choose to, mostly.
I actually didn't... I've learned something. I actually... please forgive me. I know you guys would never have made that mistake. But
it's really made often.
There's,
yeah.
I'm so sorry.
It's okay.
Within
right.
the medium.
Yes.
That you're working, you have been able with your narratives and what you're doing to actually move people in the way that great literature does and great art does. And I think that probably 10, 15, 20 years ago, people didn't think that was possible, what you've been able to achieve, and also multi-generational, what I mean? Like the way you're telling a story. For example, Ratatouille, which I should throw to a clip right now because there's a finite amount of time that we have.
Janine Garofalo, oh. Ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you. I hope there's no French people in the audience, because they're probably like, ow! With the actors that you choose when you do these things, what is it about their voices that do you, how much control do you have over that?
Choosing them?
Over like your thing, like, I want Peter O'Toole for this, or I want Patton Oswalt.
Well, obviously you're limited by how interested people are in being on your project, but I've been really lucky.
Yeah, because people don't want to work.
Well,
you,
no, I'm saying some people. Well, Peter O'Toole, for example, said, oh, I don't know, I don't really do animation. 15 years ago, I did some sort of Nutcracker thing, but as if it were like a piece of lint that he did, Nutcracker, there was something like that. And so I had to kind of woo him a little bit and say, no, you're going to love it. It's a weird part. It's you know, he really dominates the film when he's in it, and I think you'd have fun. And he kind of came around to it. And then he ended up having a great time. But some people... I think some people, actors, think it's going to be super easy, like come in, just bang out a few lines. You don't have any marks to hit. You can have a bad night, and nobody's going to know unless your voice is ragged. And they think it's going to be easy, and it's not easy. It's hard. And part of what makes it hard is that your job in some way is to inspire an animator to you know, what takes an actor 5 seconds to say may take an animator 3 weeks to animate if it's really difficult. And they are going to listen to this 1,000 times, and they want all the nuances. They want to hear it all so that they can come up with, physical stuff that is as interesting, hopefully, as the voice. And so it's actually a lot of work. And I remember Patton going, God, I'm like, at the end of the day, I'm dead.
Right.
You know, because he's having to put himself in a situation where you're thinking of everything because you're in a little booth, you know, mm-hmm. And they have to kind of bring it in a way that's a little different.
Right. And then with an accent where you feel like you're failing, that makes it even worse.
Yeah.
I actually didn't know I was supposed to do an accent at first, and neither did Will Arnett, and we coincidentally were staying in the same hotel, and he's like, did you know you were supposed to be French? And I was like, no. He didn't know he was supposed to be German either when he got there. And then
yeah, he was great.
We both had to quickly pretend we knew immediately. And then I started just watching international CNN to do that. And I can remember a friend of mine at the time, when I would run my attempts at the accent past him, he would go, is that how you're going to do it?
It's a great confidence builder.
Which is really helpful.
Yeah.
But
well, I remember you used to, like, if I complimented her after she did something, she just hated it. It did something. It made her just implode or something like that. She just didn't trust it. So very quickly, I had to learn, like, I'd go, that really sucked. And she'd go, thank you. And go right on to the next.
I feel like when somebody compliments me, I can only disappoint them after that. So...
I said she sucked a lot, and then, you know,
that
for
really
me,
was helpful.
That was the ultimate compliment, you know, because
it was great. I liked it when you did that, and I hope that you continue to do it. you know, if you would ever hire me, that would be great.
You're listening to Tribeca Film Festival Live from WNYC. Coming up after the break, more from Brad Bird and Janine Garofalo.
Now, this next clip we're going to go to, I have actually lots of questions about, which is Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. And I know that I believe that you were trying to do a film, an adaptation of a novel at the time that was not coming together, and then this came along.
Yeah, it was just a really ambitious, very incredibly rich period in history. It was called 1906, and it is a project that takes place in San Francisco right before the earthquake. And at that moment in time, San Francisco was an unbelievable, fascinating place, kind of caught between the 20th century and the 19th. And it still had gas lights and electric lights. There were horses and cars. There was the cinema. And they were still... Shanghaiing people from bars. I mean, dropping them, getting them, slipping something in their drink. They actually had trap doors in bars, and they would drop them through, and thugs would beat you up, and you would be on a boat to Shanghai. And there were people in the legislature who made money from knocking people out and selling them their services to boats where if you didn't work, they'd throw you overboard. So it's the Wild West and the 20th century at the same time. And all of there was corruption, and it was beautiful, and all this crazy stuff was happening. So the project, it was just super rich, but I couldn't find a way to corral the story into a movie-sized box. It always sprawled out this way and that, and after a while, I went, it's been too long. I can't have the rest of my career be he worked on 1906, mm-hmm. you know? So I need to do a movie, and this was the one that came along that was seemed really fun and a good opportunity. I'm still interested in doing 1906, by the way.
Well, why not as a miniseries or as a six-part?
You know, there are many advantages to that, but I love the big screen, too. And I think The Earthquake is better suited to the big screen. So, but there might be a way to do this. So
we'll put our heads together for
okay.
that one. Right now, ladies and gentlemen, a movie you may or may not have heard of, Mission Impossible, Ghost Protocol.
So that's a very strange sequence to show because it's very quiet, but...
Why is that gentleman so rattled by plumbing issues in the Kremlin? Is it that big a deal to hear a leaky faucet in the Kremlin?
I don't think a lot goes on in that hallway.
Well, you know, it is Russia. I feel like...
Plumbing is an issue.
It just seems like it wouldn't be that unusual to hear it.
Well, in the script, they had a duck quack, so...
Well, that would make no sense.
That would make zero
which brings
sense.
Which is a perfect gateway to what I would like to discuss.
Okay.
Now, when you are asked to direct something like this, which is actually bigger than all of us, like a franchise with Tom Cruise, as the director, you must have the same amount of passion, vision that you have for your projects, but you must be in some way hindered.
Well, your slot is... to fit in with the other Mission Impossible films that have been made. But one of the things that attracted me to Mission over the other things I was being offered was that it was part of the series to not have one style, that the Brian De Palma Mission looks different from the mm-hmm. John Woo Mission, which looks different than the JJ Mission. And the fact that it was willing to accommodate individual style was what was interesting to me, and they were very open about saying, if you have anything that you'd wanted to do in a spy movie, you know, we're wide open to it. And I had like six things that I wanted to do in a spy movie, and I got to do five of them. And they didn't mm-hmm. keep me from doing the sixth one. It's that the story didn't allow an opportunity for it. But I got to get them all in there, and so it was fun in that sense that we had a skeleton that we were, you know, kind of fixed too, but within that we can improvise and change things a lot.
Well, that surprised me. Because I was thinking it's got to be like the art of war.
Well,
if
it
you want
to,
with the rules of engagement of how someone like you is going to work from the top of your intelligence, as you always do, within the confines of a huge commercial venture.
Right.
And tons of other voices involved in it.
Well, but I had Tom and I had JJ, and both of them were interested in me doing my own thing. So I was kind of protected in a way, and mm-hmm. I was supported when I wanted to do something different. You know, it wasn't like I was against the world. You know, I had those guys kind of providing a little dome of protection.
Well, then why didn't you feed them? Why were they so thin? Did you notice Simon Pegg and Tom Cruise were incredibly...
Man,
thin. Craft service must have been awful on Ghost Protocol.
Actually, they had to, I mean, you know, those things are like Olympic events. And, mm-hmm. and Tom, especially, because his stuff is so physical, trains for each stunt so that he is peaking for what that particular stunt needs on that particular day. I mean, he takes it really seriously, and that's why he can do things like climb the Burj Khalifa do it and look effortless about it. He takes it really seriously.
Thank you, LRH.
Yeah, very inside reference.
Not really, that documentary.
Yeah.
Woo! Going clear. We could talk about that all day.
You know, yeah. That'll have
done,
to be
sir.
For another film festival.
Yes. But I, when, before we throw to the last clip, I was thinking about...
One of the reasons I wanted... Can I interrupt for a second? One of the reasons I wanted to...
Yes.
Just one of the reasons I wanted to put that clip in is because it's kind of... It was a little more like a silent comedy in a way. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I responded to with Tom when I first met him was we talked about movie history, what we loved, and I mentioned Harold Lloyd, and he knew all of Harold Lloyd's films. And so I could do that kind of short stroke with him, mm-hmm. and he'd know what I was talking about. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I'm sorry.
No. And actually, he can be very funny. Tom Cruise can surprise you with
how funny he is. Yeah.
And actually, Tropic Thunder I wouldn't put in that category. Only because I felt that was a little over the top.
No offense, over the top.
LRH.
The whole film is
But I feel like when he's subtle funny, he's really funny.
Did funny stuff in this film. Like when he's supposed to go climbing out the window, he has this look on his face, you know, that we discussed, you know, of him, like, I don't want to do this. Mm-hmm. Is there any other way other than doing this? And people tend to look at Simon in those scenes, but Tom is actually really funny, mm-hmm. too. Anyway, go ahead.
No, that's good. What is the toll it takes on a project like that as a director? It must be... And an unbelievably mentally and physically.
Well, it was a rough one to go into as my first live action film because it's like, you know, being thrown in the deep end of a very shark infested pool in terms of how difficult the set pieces were. They were big and they were complicated, and you had to get a lot of moving parts to fit together. But like I said, one of the things that attracted me to the project was a chance to work with Tom and a chance to work with JJ, and they were both. Could not have been more supportive. So mm-hmm. it was fun. It was hard, but it was fun.
And do you feel you would want to pursue more live action stuff, or is your heart mostly?
Well, my next film is live action, so.
No. I mean, in that type of like the big budget spy type.
Yeah.
Thing.
Yeah. Sure. If it's interesting. Yeah. Sure. I mean, they're hard, but what's fun is it's big canvas stuff, mm-hmm. and you get to. If you have a crazy big idea, you have the resources to make it happen. Mm-hmm. It's not to say it's easy, but you can do it on a grand scale that, you know, when you see it on a giant screen, it really, you know, that's fun.
And what kind of control do you have once it's done in post-production? Do you lose control in the edit room or anything?
No. I mean, sometimes you have to bark a little to get people to step back because people fret when mm-hmm. the amount of money gets that high. But... No, I've gotten to make the film so far.
Not glass. Yes.
So far, so good.
Yeah, I think you're doing okay. all right, so, Genevieve, is it time to throw to Tamara Land?
Yeah.
Tamara. They had it spelled, I mean, I know it's called Tomorrow, but they spelled it Tamarala Land. And then I thought, oh, am I saying it wrong? But it was a typo.
In New Zealand, that's what it's called.
Oh.
Yeah. I don't know why.
I love New Zealand. It's lovely. Anyhoozle, let's look at Tomorrowland.
Anyway.
The girls love it, don't they? Girls love it when the kids are eternal optimists, and yet it didn't work. Where's the jetpack?
I know. Where is the jetpack?
I mean, I hate to rain on your parade, but we don't have jetpacks.
Come May 22nd, you might.
But will we? No, I am fascinated by the 1964 World's Fair. I've seen every documentary, PBS periodically.
Me too.
Fascinated by that period, about the whole Tomorrowland thing, because as you know, they run those documentaries about that World's Fair.
Right.
So, were you shooting and actually in is it Flushing Meadow?
No, actually, we did it with special effects and redressed something in mm-hmm. Vancouver, but
Vancouver is where it's all happening. It's all happening in Vancouver.
But you know, it kind of came out of these conversations I had with Damon Lindelof, who produced it and co-wrote the script with me and had the original idea, that we started saying, you know, what happened to the future, that when we were kids, the future seemed always to be this bright, better thing. And yet and the world was still a dark place back then. There were a lot of bad things happening everywhere. Mm-hmm. But there was this optimism about the future. And we started going, why did that disappear? Because if you ask people now, generally, the point of view is that the future is going to stink and that it's not going to be good and we're probably doomed. And everybody's kind of resigned to it. And we just kind of went, why is that? What changed? I mean, the world has still got problems, but it had them back then. And why did the future change?
Well, I think climate change has something to do with it.
But no, but what I'm saying is we can... But we had the atomic bomb. No, I'm just saying there were millions of bad things back then.
No, I agree with you.
But our attitude towards those things was, we can figure it out, and that attitude is gone. And yet we're still as in control of our future as we've ever been. It's just that we have to take the reins.
I actually would disagree with you. There is as much as there's cynicism, there is a ton of optimism, a ton of people finding ways to hopefully reset what
I agree with
is
that,
the future.
But it's not the zeitgeist. The zeitgeist is doom and gloom, apocalypse sells. If you try to present a rosy vision of the future, you're considered quaint and naive. And that's not to say that it won't be a huge struggle to get there. But I feel like there's been sort of a throwing in of the towel, and I don't agree with it.
Well, there is. It depends on in the political realm. There's the myth of the bright future that is sold to certain people, and then there's because they don't want to hear about realities.
Of course,
because you have to do things to change things.
Exactly.
But
that's the point. You have to do things to change things.
Right.
And people have. Admittedly, there are lots of people working on making the world a better place. One of them is Elon Musk, who is pushing, gave away all of his patents to Tesla because he mm-hmm. wants Detroit mm-hmm. to make electric cars. And I think that's great, but I'm just saying that's not the general direction. People are sold that the future is going to be worse than their parents. And I feel like there's a resignation to it, and I don't think there should mm-hmm. be a resignation.
Well, like I said, I think it's half and half. I think that there is... As much as there is the cynicism and the fear, there is so many people trying to find new ways to live and new ways to bring a better future if we can.
And
have
our film
one.
Is in support of those people.
I can tell that just by the amount of discussion of the optimism this can work in the face of his angry dad.
Yeah.
Who says it can't work.
Yeah.
Who is also he made it out of bon ton. You see that documentary True Blood? That documentary, True Blood, on HBO. A lot of problems in Bon Ton. That guy was Andy Belfleur. Maybe that's his father or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, there's but probably 19, some sort of tie-in.
But 1964 also was an interesting year.
Yeah, really?
Not just because of the Beatles and Jeanine Garofalo was born. But there was something, so much was going on at 64.
Yes, absolutely.
And it's almost like it was the perfect time to have that particular World's Fair.
Yeah, it was. And you know, where have World's Fairs gone? They were kind of, in a way, an Olympics for ideas of the future.
Well, it's because they were brought to you. Now people have access where they didn't have access, and it was an event to go see what you could see.
Right.
The future was going to be like.
But I feel like it's dispersed because of that in some mm-hmm. way. And I love the fact that the internet makes those things available to us, but it also makes a lot of garbage available to us too. Mm-hmm. And you have to go through and pick and choose, whereas the World's Fairs generally were a place where ideas kind of swam upstream. And you got to see glimpses of the future that were positive and you know.
Unfortunately for the cities that host them, they tend to lose money on them.
Yeah.
That's what the documentary said. In it. Genevieve, which part are we at now? Before we do the audience, I want you to know I had copious notes and stuff, and then I got embarrassed about not only my penmanship, which is horrible, but I'm embarrassed to ask these questions. But your social consciousness that you have as a person, as a human, and as your optimism, do you think that that's part of also when you grew up, when you were a teenager, the time that you were, does that inform the work that you're doing now?
I think to some extent, you know, and I'm probably only aware of half the ways that it is, but, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, it's really hard to look at your own stuff and try to analyze it with any kind of objectivity. You don't. You know, you have to kind of rely on other people to, you know, see what things keep popping up again. Because when you're doing it, you're just going, well, that would be cool. Oh, that would be cool. Why don't we do that? You know, and then it tends to be whatever it is. But, yeah, I think the stories that, you know, I love popcorn movies as much as any kind of movie. And I truly, genuinely love them. But I like when there's a little more to chew on them.
Right.
And I think that I got interested in movies in the 70s when, you know, and I was a kid, but I was becoming aware of what the language of movies in the 70s when people, there was a really wide range mm-hmm. of films being made. I mean, you know, you would have Annie Hall up against Star Wars for Best Picture. It just was a really interesting time in cinema. Mm-hmm. And I felt like a lot of those films could dazzle you and entertain the hell out of you, but you come out of the theater and you're still thinking about them.
Right.
And I like that. I think that's great.
That's what, when I was talking earlier about the narratives and the way that what you're doing actually can move people, I don't know that there would have been a lot of people, like I said, 25 years ago or so, that would have thought that could be achieved. The stories that you tell, the way that you tell them, within your medium.
Very carefully done.
Medium.
Thank you.
Where do you want to push it to? What is it? And if you were to adapt 1906, would you consider adapting it not live action? I mean, that's insane.
That's not the way I see it. It's weird because I see certain ideas certain ways. And certainly the argument, when I was first starting in animation, some of the old guys, not the best old guys, the more hacky old guys would say, if you can do it in live action, don't do it in animation, which I always thought was idiotic because mm-hmm. it was dooming animation to being obsolete because right. live action was capable of doing more every year. And now, you know, they've made Pigs Talk, you know, they do E.T., they can do Lord of the Rings, they can do anything now. And animation to me is still as relevant as it's ever been. That's never been the reason to do animation, is to do what live action can't do. It's to take ideas that can benefit from having the essence of them turned up. And that's mm-hmm. what animation is. It's like a good caricature of W.C. Fields looks more like W.C. Fields than W.C. Fields
right.
does. And that's what good animation does. There's certain ideas, like Incredibles could have been done as a live action film, but I saw it as an animated film. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Ratatouille could have been done with a little CG rat and it had been done as a live action film, but I don't see that the same way. And I see 1906 as a live action film. And Tomorrowland could have been done as an animated film, but I see it as a live action
right.
film. So I love both mediums, and I just have certain ways that I'd love to tell certain stories. And you know, so far it's worked out.
So far so good, but we're waiting on the jetpacks. Anyway,
yeah.
Going to the Q&A of the audience.
Yes.
There will be people handing mics out if you have questions.
And you can take them
questions.
Home.
Yes, these yeah. are for you. These are complimentary
yeah.
courtesy of the Tribeca
Film Festival.
Film yeah. Festival.
Put in a good word.
You're listening to Tribeca Film Festival Live from WNYC. Coming up after the break, more from Brad Bird and Janine Garofalo.
There's hands up. Sure, you.
Hey, man. I just wanted to say, I was watching The Iron Giant and The Incredibles recently, and one thing that I'm always amazed at is just how well these animated films convey light so well to tell and express mood. And one thing that I just wanted to know, moving into Ghost Protocol and Tomorrowland, what it was like working with Claudio and Bob
Robert Elswit,
versus a team of animators to capture and convey light.
I think you're having a lot of the same conversations because you're still trying to sell a scene and put it over, and you know, when we do a CG film, unlike a hand-drawn film, you're dealing with people who are in charge of photography. And on Ratatouille, we had Sharon Callahan, who'd done several Pixar films and is brilliant. And she knew all these cinematographers. She knew all the work of them. So I could say, this shot is kind of like, it's like Robert Richardson. And she'd go, I know what you mean, like the top light? And I go, yeah, exactly. And so we could use that shorthand of knowing what certain cinematographers did as shorthand for, like, that's how to approach this shot. So it's really the same stuff. It's just the tools are a little different. Yeah.
You?
Hello. So now that we've clarified the difference between medium and genre, you've done family films, you've done a spy film, now you've done Tomorrowland, which we'll find out what it is. But are there any...
Who knows what it is, really? I don't know.
Are there other genres that you would like to try your hand at as
you
a
bet.
Filmmaker in either?
I would love to do a Western. I'd love to do a musical. I'd love to do a lot of different things. What you are trying to figure out is what you would do that is different than what's been done, and which films you're inspired by and which ones you want to stay away from. Like, I have certain Westerns that I love and certain Westerns that I'm like, so it's, you know, the ones that stick are the ones that ultimately influence you.
Let's go in the back with the red cap. I feel horrible. Jeez, it's like the lottery.
I love
and
the way
the
you...
And not the good one either. Shirley Jackson's one. Not the good lottery.
I love when you pick someone, you go, you?
It's...
Yeah.
I don't want to offend anyone. Anyway, the gentleman in the red cap.
No, I was just curious what that last thing that you didn't get to put in Ghost Protocol was with the spy.
What the five things were?
Oh,
well,
the
no, just
thing.
The last one. That
oh, the
you didn't
the
get to
oh
put
yeah.
In.
Well, then I'm giving up the idea.
I know.
I don't want to do that because ideas find their way into other films. Mm-hmm. There, I was doing a failed project that I tried to do for years was an animated version of The Spirit, Will Eisner's comic strip, and there was a gag in The Spirit that I did where the spirit is on the phone and he keeps hanging it up and it keeps falling off and finally he's like slamming it down multiple times, and that showed up in Iron Giant. The opportunity to do that showed up in Iron Giant with Kent Mansley. So ideas find their ways into other films, and so I don't want to give up the idea because it might go into another film.
You? Yeah.
Particularly where animation's concerned.
Oh, well, television has its own challenges, as you are very aware. Mm-hmm. It's you have to produce it. If you're doing a show, you have to produce it very quickly. And the image that kept popping up with me when I was working, and I worked on 8 seasons of The Simpsons as a consultant. I was there probably 2 days out of every week, sometimes 3. It's kind of like that thing of I Love Lucy where she has the chocolates, mm-hmm. and she has to, and she kind of keeps shoving more chocolates down because she can't keep up with them. If you slow down on television, you will get eaten alive. And there were episodes of The Simpsons. I learned a hell of a lot from being on that show because I saw episodes that were deeply in trouble up to 2 weeks before they were going to air. And these are things that take 6 months to go through the whole process from the beginning of the writing to the end of shooting color. And they would be almost done and things wouldn't work. And then somebody would make a genius move of re-editing something or revoicing one part and suddenly they would work beautifully. And so it was like storytelling camp. And because the Simpsons scripts, as googly-eyed as everybody is and crazy-looking, the scripts are actually very sophisticated and would have an A story and a B story and sometimes a C story and keep things popping. In 22 minutes, they would do like 40 minutes worth of material and just So I learned a lot from being on that. Television forces you to make decisions quickly, and that has served me very well in film, because with Iron Giant, we had a limited budget and a shortened schedule compared to DreamWorks or Disney films. With Incredibles, we had this great studio and a big budget and support, but we wanted to make a film that was 3 times bigger than any one they had done without it costing any more money. So all the TV stuff really was handy, because you cannot linger over a decision. You have to just make it and move on in TV, and that has been great for me in movies.
Will you start picking the people?
Will I start what?
Picking the people.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'll be ruthless. You know, never. You know, yeah. Hi. Yes.
Okay, hello. I'm sorry about my English. I'm from Brazil.
Okay. I'm sorry about my English, too. So we're even.
Okay, it's a curious answer. How your process to collect and select your insights and ideas, because obviously you have a lot of elements to make incredible narratives, and how your process?
It's different for each film. They're highly individual, and they happen in very different ways. There's a film that I wanted to make and still want to make called Ray Gunn. That idea happened because I was listening to the radio, and there was this music, and it sounded like Peter Gunn. It was dun 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 dun. And so I go, this is Peter Gunn, and then it goes, whee! And I go, that's not Peter Gunn. What is that?
It was Planet Claire by
Planet Claire by B-52s. exactly. But I went, that's not Peter Gunn, that's Ray Gunn. And then I went, what would Ray Gunn be? And I just started to ask myself all these questions, and then you come up with answers that entertain you, and that then you have a story. So that in that instance, it was inspired by a song, but no two happen alike. Oh, okay, yes. The one with the Pixar cap. Bases are loaded.
So I have a physics question for you.
And I'm also liable to flunk.
Yeah, right.
I'll answer it pre-advanced. I don't know.
You don't know?
Okay. Moving on to the next question.
Question about creating genuine peril. Because I've read that Walt Disney wasn't afraid of scaring children.
No, that's exactly right. And it's what a lot of people get wrong about Disney. Among the piles of things that people get wrong about Disney. Yes. In fact, they had to reupholster the seats in a very large movie palace in New York because little kids were peeing on the seats when the witch came on in Snow White. They had to reupholster after about, you know, a month. They had to, yeah, because the pee was eating into the, well, we don't need, anyway, I think that I always admired that about Walt era films, is that they were not afraid to be really scary. And my favorite Disney film Walt Disney film was Pinocchio, which is, I still find scary. And I love that about it, that it was willing to be dark and you know, go there. You know, the scene where they transform into donkeys, you know, was done in a way that still scares the crap out of me. And I think that's great. In fact, I think in animation, you talk about what animation should do. Animation should do a balls-out horror movie, absolutely. And, you know, that's what everybody thought Black Cauldron was going to be, and then it just was bad on 400 different levels. But and that's for another film festival.
My physics question really
quickly. Oh, no, no. No, you're limited to one question and no physics.
Well, that's,
I'm being brutal.
It's time to hear.
You.
Yes. Actually, we should, I feel like we're staying
front
too,
row.
Too front.
Okay, well, you have an opinion. Take
well,
it over.
Well, now you go, and then we need
yours.
To be more fair.
Next one's yours.
And go back.
Next one's yours.
Okay.
Okay, yes.
So you've mentioned finding literature that you enjoy and then talking about also animation and live action. Have you ever considered doing a movie where it's combining both based on a story that people love, like The Phantom Tollbooth or something along those lines?
I have a movie that combines them, but it's not the Phantom Toll Booth kind of thing where two different realities that you cut back and forth between. I don't know. Those kind of work. I mean, there's been a lot of bad ones like that, like Pagemaster and stuff like that, you know. I don't know, maybe. I have one that combines them, but combines them in a different kind of way. But, yeah, sure. I mean, yeah, those mediums can play well with each other, sure. Janine.
Okay, in the back, and also we probably shouldn't wait for mics because then you can get more questions in, but you're going to have to project as if you're in the theater. Sir, right there. Yes, direct to you. Right there.
In Ratatouille, you see that the influence by cinematography, you had this rock focus. In your animation work, has that influenced your direction of actors?
I see it all as kind of the same thing. You're still working with the same language. Some people like to do really deep focus, and some films like Citizen Kane have really benefited from it. But for me, focus is another way to direct the eye. And I like the fact that CG animation, you can mimic a real lens. Part of what you're talking about in Ratatouille was I wanted it to feel small. In other words, that you were... It's subtle, but there's a way to do it where it seems enormous and like you're small, and there's a way to seem like you're small, and there's a way to make the room just seem enormous, and they're not the same thing. And I wanted it to seem like we were small. And one thing that I noticed is when you photograph things in with real lenses, when they're small, the focal length becomes very short. So if you try to get close to a rat's face, his nose might be in focus, but his eyes won't be in focus because they're small. And so I said, I want the camera to mimic being small. And so the focal length gets very short when you're close to Remy, and it gets longer when you're with the real people. And that is something the computer did not want to do. It wants to do deep focus. And everybody was like, well, you don't want deep focus? You can see everything. Why don't you want that? I said, because I don't feel small. You know, I want to feel tiny. I want to feel like we have a little tiny rat cam and a little tiny rat cinematographer, and he's, you know. And for all those shots, I want them shot by the union rat cinematographer, you know. So anyway.
Okay, we're only allowed to have one more.
This is worth the price of admission right here.
You? I'm so sorry. We only get that.
You thank suck. You.
I know. Oh, thank you.
Thank you. Okay.
Brad, I was very moved by when you were sharing before about the future, how, as we were kids, was promised beautiful, and now how so much of media is being shown that apocalyptic here, apocalypse there. What do you feel should be the... as a storyteller, as someone who's, you know, a storyteller, like an ancient storyteller, like a shaman, or that how we should, as overall in media, should be promoting more of this kind of to influence people's consciousness and be like a different level of that.
Yeah, I shy away from getting too prescribing. Well, this is what the world needs right now through the media. But I do believe storytelling is powerful, and that the stories we tell each other in whatever form, reflect what's going on in our minds. And they, I'm not saying that they all have to be uplifting stories. So some of my favorite stories have sad endings or dark endings. And it's just that the stories that I'm drawn to are a little more glass half full. That's probably just more who I am. I am cynical in a way, but it's about that deep. If you go scratch it a little bit underneath, I'm an optimist.
Can we say you're jetpacky?
I'm kind of jetpacky.
Jetpacky.
With a longer range, though.
But that's more like, Brad Bird, he's jetpacky.
Yeah.
You know, he believes we're actually going to have one soon.
I don't believe. Well, we
I like
do
that
have
about
them.
You.
They're just not.
They just don't
long
work.
Range.
They yeah. don't work the way that we were promised.
That's right. Damn it.
Now, in summation.
What have we learned today?
What have we learned today? It's good to have your parents be connected with someone at Disney.
My parents were connected to somebody who was connected with somebody who was. I'm more of the people.
And then also to be talented. That helps too. I'm sorry we couldn't get to all your questions, but I'm sure Brad Willman, I'm going to be handing out his phone number. And just to ring him up on his cell. You don't mind?
Or you can stalk Janine. Either one works. Yeah.
But I think they have more questions for you, and I feel like, you know, you're such an optimist. you're such an Airbnb type of guy in the sharing economy. But anyway, thank you all so much for coming.
This is Tribeca Film Festival Live from WNYC. On the next episode, Christian Slater talks about leading an army of hackers against an Illuminati-like group of bad guys in the USA Network's new show, Mr. Robot.